Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. My apologies for the fact that I sound like I've got a head full of hay fever, but I've got a head full of hay fever. Luckily, hay fever isn't contagious. And anyway, I'm not in the same room as our guest, which is Jack Howard. Jack,
hello,
welcome
sir.
Again through the miracle of Zoom. Why are you wearing a baseball cap?
Because I've been swimming today and my hair would be incredible without it. And I don't want to distract from the subject that we're talking about. It would just be huge and out of control.
You don't think that wearing a baseball cap isn't distracting?
I think
there's a brilliant bit in the novel of...
Do you not think it looks good on me? I think I've got a little bit of a director look. I think it suits me.
Okay, firstly, Jack,
I must admit I do like it for that reason.
I didn't say anything about it not looking good. I think that's your inner paranoia speaking. Secondly, it reminds me, there's a lovely scene in the novel of Legion, which people may not have read, in which Kinderman is talking to, is it Ryan? And Ryan comes in wearing a hat, and Kinderman makes a thing about he says, what are you doing? Are you auditioning for Moby Dick or something? And Ryan takes the hat off, and then Kinderman says, yeah, the crew cut is worse, put the hat back on again.
my dad has always made, one of my best friends growing up is
not
gingerhead.
Right, yeah.
And my dad always is like, if they're coming over to the house, they've got to put hats on. I don't want the neighbours seeing that we've got gingers coming around the house. You've got to put a hat on.
Racist.
Gingist.
Yeah, so anyway, okay, well, so yes, you are speaking to us with your Steven Spielberg hat on. Now, in a way, this
Thank
is
you.
Strangely appropriate because you're in your bedroom and all mic'd up. I'm in my cupboard under the stairs and all mic'd up. And this week, we're going to talk about Bo Burnham's Netflix special, Inside, which was... Oddly enough, somebody had raised the question of, are you going to review this as a movie? Because it's like an hour and 20, so it's technically a feature-length thing. And this came up because you said, look, we must talk about Inside. So I've now seen it. I know that you have a lot to say about it. And I'm going to allow you to start.
Okay, well, what an honour.
Off you go.
Okay, so for those of you who don't know Bo Burnham's work... He was one of the first generation YouTube people. I think there's a lot of people now, even to this day, who are making stuff or beginning to make stuff that even if they don't know that they're inspired by Bo Burnham, I think he basically was a creator of, or like at least a leader in the generation of influencers, as you'd call them now. He started out just putting up songs up that he would do in his bedroom. When he was like 16 years old, and he had roaring success very, very quickly. He worked very hard, did a lot of live shows in like the Edinburgh Fringe. He toured them around. I went to go see Bo Burnham when I was, it was 2009, I think. I dragged my dad to Sheffield.
Wow.
I'm from Nottingham. I got him to take me to this Bo Burnham performance before he was like, you know, outside of internet world famous.
Yeah.
And it was like a tiny little space with a stage that was, you know, no higher than your knees, tiny little living room space with like 20 people there. My dad must have been like, what is this? Like, because he did like a lot of the stuff that's quite surreal that he does later when he's refined it. But in a room full of 20 people, it can read quite weird when he's miming to be a T-Rex. What was your introduction to Bo Burnham?
Well,
when did you discover who he was, Mark?
Well, have a guess at how I discovered Bo Burnham, Jack.
I assume 8th grade?
No, way before that. Gabriel, my son.
Okay.
You know, who's...
All right, well, there we go.
So that was it. He was constantly watching and listening to Bo Burnham, and I did the typical dad thing. Hello, child, what is that interesting thing that you're watching? And then, of course, the next thing you go, oh, actually, this is really interesting. And so I knew Bo Burnham's stuff from that. And then, of course, you know, Eighth Grade, which was such a stunningly brilliant piece of work and one of my favourite films of that year. And, of course, as we keep saying, one of Obama's favourite films of that year. I think one of the best portrayals of coming of age and the difficulties of being... you know, of growing up in the age of the internet. And then, of course, people will recently have seen Bo Burnham, who plays a key role in Promising Young Woman, which was, you know, big Oscar celebrate. But so, yes, so now, as you say, you know, famous outside of the internet, but I knew about him because he was famous to my son. And
which is why you know about me.
Which is why I know about you. This whole thing is kind of very, very cyclical. That's right. If I didn't have a smart kid, I would never know about any of this stuff. So I'm just saying that to credit it, because that's how I found out about it. Okay, so.
Well, I owe your son so much. Like, this is the reason why we have this show together. But yeah, like, I mean, that you basically filled in the rest of Bo Burnham's journey there. And now, I think kind of quietly, he decided to quit performing, and he reveals why in the new special Inside.
Can we
talk about that?
Can we say
why? Yeah, I think so. Let's just say, like, if you haven't seen Inside, I would consider like this a spoiler, completely like spoiler filled discussion. So definitely go and watch Inside and then come back to this, because I don't want to spoil anything from it, because it's such a unique first experience, like in terms of how he plays with form and what he's, I don't know, just like the presentation of it is so unlike anything else I've ever seen. It's such a combination of different art forms that I just can't recommend it on that alone. Just go and have a good first experience, and then let's have a chat about all of that stuff.
So it's on Netflix, and we'll now talk as if, you know, assuming that that people do have some awareness of it, that he says that what happens is he essentially got stage fright, that he was
having panic attacks. He said he was having severe panic attacks on stage, and he's talked about this before in interviews where he said, like, oh, I just power through them, and because my stage show is like scripted to the word, it's almost like he comes out of himself and is able to just like carry on with muscle memory, but inside his brain he's been freaking out. And he said he had like 9 out of 10 panic attacks that he's had, at least this was the last time he spoke about it, he had 9 of them on stage, which is just, as he says in the show, not a great place to have them.
You want to hear a funny story? So, 5 years ago, I quit performing live comedy because I was beginning to have severe panic attacks while on stage, which is not a great place to have them. So I quit. I didn't perform for 5 years. I spent that time trying to improve myself mentally. And you know what? I did. I got better. I got so much better, in fact, that in January of 2020, I thought, you know what? I should start performing again. I've been hiding from the world, and I need to re-enter. And then the funniest thing happened. Were you feeling nervous? Were you having fun? It's almost over. It's just begun.
Well, look, we'll come back to that because I have a particular experience of that as well. But just again, so to set...
Oh, really?
We'll come back to it. So to set this up, so this is the first of these shows that he's done, you know, for a while. So tell us what... Basically, give us a description of it, Jack. What is it?
It is Bo Burnham creating, writing, directing, editing, singing and dancing an hour and a half special from the inside of his room. In one room, he uses that as the stage and does everything himself. He's basically created this whole thing from nothing on his own within the last year during the pandemic. And so, obviously, a lot of the themes are very relevant to everybody right now. What did you think, Mark? What were your initial thoughts?
Well, hang on, let's finish
describing. Oh, sorry, am I rushing ahead?
No, it's fine. I just think so. Essentially, it is a show presented without a live audience from, you say room, we sort of discover at the end, but it might be a hut, but it's an enclosed space.
You know what's interesting as well is that hut, that little apartment space that he's performing from, is at the end of his last live show, and it's revealed that it is essentially, like, his house is clearly just along the path, and this is like his little studio in his garden.
Yeah,
but yeah, he fully makes you believe that he lives there.
That he's in there, and it appears to be shot over a lengthy period because the length of his hair, the length of his beard, the state of his face, the state of his everything changes, and you get the impression that what you are watching, and I say get the impression because I'm taking this on good faith, mm-hmm. that what you are watching is something that's been created over a period of about a year of somebody either unspooling or generating creative energy from the experience of having been shut inside for a year. And the subjects that he addresses are variously the subject of isolation, the subject of people constantly being online. There is a song about sexting. There's a
thing about performative activism.
I have to say, the thing that really, really struck me, there is a thing in which he does a routine and then he films himself commenting on the routine. And then he ends up filming himself, commenting on the routine, which is kind of like a Twilight Zone sort of.
It's amazing.
A lot of it is about the way in which the sort of isolating effect of recording and internet and YouTube and everything has been magnified by the pandemic. That idea that you are talking into an echo room, but you might well be talking to yourself. There are a couple of moments in which he plays songs and he very specifically reaches out to touch the laughter button. So he gives himself a ripple of laughter because there isn't an audience there with him. So
there's also like the way that he shoots it a lot of the time. This isn't like a strict rule, but the door and the air conditioner wall seems to be the stage. And then whenever the camera faces the other way, it's a little bit like you're seeing a behind the scenes element to it. And there's throughout, it feels like you're seeing art and artist simultaneously. So it kind of feels like you're watching the final product and him making it simultaneously.
Yes, and he talks constantly about, I haven't finished this yet, I'm not going to finish it because I don't want it to stop. There is a moment in which he appears to break down and cry, although that seems to me to be a performative moment. And one of the things that the whole show raises all the way through is what you're watching a performance? Mm-hmm. Is it real? How much of this do we trust? Which is why I say it seems as though it's being filmed over the space of
He even announces that, and obviously he could be lying, but I think that what's interesting about it, like where the line blurs between fiction and reality, and does it matter? Does it make it less honest if it is a performance of that's coming from somewhere honest?
Yep.
But
okay.
Yeah, like there's a moment, for example, when he gets into an unfolded bed, and when I was watching it with somebody who said, "Oh, Bo," like that, as if he was really doing that, and then he switches on the spotlight, and that whole time it makes me feel like something that he always does in his shows, which he's telling you, this is not real. You are watching a performance. I'm lying to you. And he said that on many occasions throughout his performance on stage.
Yeah, so again, I stress that thing about whatever it seems it is, whether it actually is or is, isn't really the point. So, firstly, you are very, very impressed by it. Yes,
I'm enamored. So I watched it the first time.
Tell me what you love.
Well, so much of it. I mean, first of all, let's go to the basic stuff, which is the songs are all absolute bangers. Every single one slaps for different reasons. He starts the show making quite almost that feel on the surface like parody internet songs. So you've got a song about sexting and white woman's Instagram and things like that feel like quite surface level jokes, even though they're not. There's definitely stuff going on underneath the surface. And then as he goes on, the songs kind of intentionally or not, depending on how he felt when he was making them, kind of stop needing to be funny. And feeling like he's just creating beautiful songs. There's an amazing song called That Funny Feeling, which I think has become a bit of a fan favorite quite quickly. where it feels like a Bob Dylan song or something.
This is where he sits and plays guitar. He says at the beginning, I can't play the guitar and I can't sing.
Or sing,
and then he sits and plays the guitar.
And plays one of the most beautiful songs I've heard in the past few years.
So, okay, so this is kind of leading slightly towards... You see, I have to be honest about this. I'm less certain about this than you are.
The first time I watched it, I was like, that was obviously great. That was obviously great. And it kind of fits in with what we've been talking about recently, the idea of the ghost stories and also timey-wimey stuff. Because as we've been talking about anyway, this past year has felt a bit like a big Groundhog Day.
Yeah, no kidding.
This show has that effect, and there's a benefit to the rewatching of it. There's something about, and I've seen this, has been an effect in general, that people have watched it and gone, yeah, that was obviously great, very good, very talented. And then you watch it again and go, oh, no, this is a masterpiece. And how I feel about it is that it feels like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity of a masterpiece. Like, this could never have been made previously for many reasons, because of where Bo Burnham comes from in his roots, the time of year, obviously the pandemic that's happened. But for me, this whole show feels like something he was bursting to talk about, and the lockdown situation has just been the perfect way to allow an audience on a mass scale to understand him or to be able to interpret what he wants to talk about, which I think is his struggle with the creative process. And I think that room is real for him every single time he wants to make something. And there's a lyric where he says, look who went outside, look who went out looking for a reason to hide again, look who's back inside again. And that to me feels like the experience that he has, where he'll go and live a bit of life for a bit, and then he'll use what he's found when he's been living and put that into the art that he wants to make. But he always ends up going back into this room. And for him, that's a constant thing. But this time he's managed to sort of show that to people. And we make sense of it. Even if you're not a creative person, you make sense of it because we've all been locked in our rooms, literally. But yeah, I feel like that for him is real every single time he wants to make something.
Okay.
So, went off on a bit of a tangent there. I'm going to shut up for a bit and let you say what you think.
Not a tangent at all. And I'll be honest, I don't entirely know what I think. I've only seen it once. My problem is this. Firstly, I mean, I said I've been a fan of Bo Burnham before, both of his, you know, the comedy on the internet, but and as a film director and as an actor. And I was doing the Observer thing about, you know, choose your Oscars. I thought he should have been nominated for a supporting actor Oscar for Promising Young Woman, because actually the role that he plays in that film is the pivotal, if you don't buy into that role, the whole of the kind of central reveal of the film doesn't work.
And what an excellent piece of metacasting as well.
What an excellent piece of metacasting,
because you like Bo Burnham so much.
Exactly. And that's a smart move. So here's what I worry about. Firstly, I worry about the here I am having a hard time. I mean, one of the things that he does is he does a lot of stuff about, you know, a white privileged person, you know, why do we need to hear that voice again? And he does songs saying, you know, why do we need to hear that voice again? The whole point about it being you're hearing that voice again, asking that question. Fine. And then there's White Woman's Instagram, which actually I thought was kind of the laziest of all the songs, which just seemed to be a kind of collection of slightly wry, but also, you know, observation about, you know, a white woman's Instagram feed, which is like, yeah, okay, I'm not sure whether that's a high enough target. I don't think for one minute that there aren't things in it that are smart and clever, but I just think it's kind of fairly low-hanging fruit for him. The second thing is, one of the things that started to get on my nerves was the kind of constant vacillating between, on the one hand, you know, I'm doing a kind of confessional look at me, this is the inside of me, and I'm, you know, and on the other hand, that kind of that arch smile that he does. So one of the things that Bo Burnham does is he delivers songs with this kind of arch, cheesy, theatrical smile, which at one point, incidentally, he holds on camera for far too long, so it becomes uncomfortable so that you're looking at it. So part of what he's doing is, I'm doing an act about doing an act, and, you know, I'm doing a meta text about doing a meta text, which is fine up to a point. But there is a point that part of me starts to think, okay, is this just indulgent? And the two things that would have stopped me thinking that are, firstly, if I was laughing more, which I wasn't. So I did laugh considerably less at this than I have done at some of his other work. I mean, you know, the argument will be, well, it's because it's less funny because it's deeper. And the other thing is the feeling of the performative inner-outer life thing is only engaging in so much as what you think you're learning is something new. And I ended up thinking, you know the bit when he's sitting on the chair and he looks up at the glitter ball with the torch? That's a great moment. What an amazing opener. But the problem is I'm looking at it thinking, wow, that's a really technically clever idea, not something else. And I don't know whether I kept thinking this feels indulgent, and it feels like it's forgiving itself for its indulgence by being aware of its indulgence. And it ended up, and I am playing devil's advocate here because I think it's probably better than this, but it ended up feeling to me like the person at the party who talks about themselves for half an hour and constantly makes jokes about the fact that they're talking about themselves, but still carry on talking about themselves. And it reminds me of that line about, enough about me, let's talk about you, what do you think about me? You know, it started to grate, and that bothered me, Jack. And it bothered me because I thought, I know that there's more going on here than this. And it may be a generational thing. It may
potentially
be, yeah, it may well be. I thought the sexting thing was like kind of, yeah, you know, I mean, I don't look, I'm nearly 60, so I have never
sexed.
No, I've never done it.
I guess all of those jokes just whoosh.
No, I got them. The thing is that I got them because they're kind of fairly low-hanging fruit. I mean, it's like, if I understand a song about it, I mean, the gags are kind of self-explanatory. You sort of understand what it is. But I don't know that saying sexting is weird is particularly, I mean, of course it's weird, you know, and next. And I thought that the bit that really bothered me was the bit when he appeared to break down in tears, because it was like, it's a trick. It's a like, okay, am I supposed to now feel sorry because you're crying? Or am I supposed to feel suckered because you're acting crying, which you may well be because the whole thing is a conceit. And it started to annoy me. And actually talking about it, I'm liking it less. And I think, therefore, that firstly, I should see it again, probably, because I do think that he's really talented and I think he's done some really smart work in the past. But does any of this make any sense to you? I started to really feel like there was a level of indulgence in it that I didn't want to indulge in.
Do you know what's interesting is that my first response to that is that he knows it's indulgent and he's constantly talking about how this is indulgent, but he wants to do it anyway.
Yes.
And he also in the special says being self-aware doesn't absolve anybody of anything.
Yes.
So I think what you're talking about, he's painfully aware of, to the point of, all I want to do is write songs and make music and tell jokes about this sort of stuff, but I also like know that it's just me being like, oh, look at me, because he even says that in the opening thing, like, I can only do this while getting paid and being the center of attention.
Yes.
So I think that,
and the thing about, I mean, I'm making comedy to save the world, and
yes,
you know, and I have to find a way of doing it that enables me to get paid and still make it all about me. But that's exactly what I mean about the thing about the person talking about themselves and constantly saying they're talking about themselves but still talking, yep, about themselves.
Totally. And I can see why that would grate on you. But I think what I see is somebody who's going, I think that too, but I can't help that this is what I want to create and this is all I have. This is literally, I've never seen a more honest presentation of, this is all I have to offer you.
Okay.
Like even the ending when he like holds the microphone and just goes, I think I'm done. Like it feels like he's never satisfied with how he's making something, or that he'd be so self-critical of himself. And you see that in his reaction video sketch that he does, which to me
is the best
immediately
thing.
It's so good. Like immediately that read to me as like, this is literally his inner psyche. We are seeing his inner psyche, like the stages he goes through where he writes a silly song that he likes, and then he'll watch it and be like, this is what I meant by that, I'm still excited about it. And then the next stage of him will say, being, I'm trying to act like the thing I'm writing is smarter than it is. It's just a silly song. And then he says, oh, that's my initial reaction to something because I'm worried that that criticism is going to be leveled against me. So I level it against myself before anyone else can. And I relate so much, Mark. I relate so much to that. That process as well of like, and sometimes that process happens before you've made the thing. Yeah. So you don't make it in the end. And what I see here is somebody who has made the thing and gone through that process and decided still, sure, he's probably sold it for millions of dollars and he's doing pretty well off of it, like the album as well. Sure. But he finished the thing. He sort of did all he could. Like, it feels like he's literally got his blood, sweat and tears in this. And to respond as well to like the low-hanging fruit stuff about sexting and about white woman's Instagram, obviously a big theme in this as well is our relationship with our screens and with the internet. Very directly, does he make a song called Welcome to the Internet where he does it from the point of view of the internet as a villain, like almost like a Disney villain. But then there's the whole thing is like his relationship with the internet, our generation's relationship with the internet. Like, he point blank says to the audience, don't come crawling back to me when you've developed a disassociative disorder, mental disorder in your late 20s. He's basically just saying, I think this isn't great. And he lets you in at the beginning with really relatable, playful, almost Lonely Island parody-esque songs. I'm going to FaceTime with my mom. That's a connection you should have in person. And he's doing it through a screen and he's just demonstrating how kind of strange that is. White Woman's Instagram, I think, is the first example of him criticizing. Well, it's not actually the first example because there's a sock before that, I think, which is amazing. But the White Woman's Instagram, the changing aspect ratio moment, I think a lot of people have been speaking about this online, so I'm not saying anything particularly new. But the whole thing obviously is done in a square to represent how Instagram photos initially looked. Obviously, now you can do many different aspect ratios. Fun fact, but this one obviously is done for in a square just to give you that impression. And there's a moment when he kind of humanizes the woman that he's talking about and talks, and it feels like he's been doing research on Instagram and making fun of all the cliches that he's seeing. And then he comes across this one caption where a woman is talking about her mom that had passed away. But the aspect ratio changes for a brief moment while she really is vulnerable. She displays this moment where she's like, I miss my mom. I miss sitting in the back garden with you. And then the aspect ratio immediately starts going back to a square as she then turns back and goes into, I've done so well. I've got a job and a boyfriend and an apartment. She starts bragging again about her life. And I think that there's just, that to me felt like what the whole kind of show is about, is that there are these brief moments where people let their real thoughts or real selves through. But most of the time there is a real thought and performance to everything that everybody does. And that's made stronger now because of our relationship with our devices and with the internet. And obviously it's not all bad, and I think he knows that. Like, it's afforded so many, like, we wouldn't be able to continue this show without the internet.
No, you know? I know. And I mean,
he wouldn't have a career without the internet. So I think, but what I think he's doing is talking about that a lot. And
okay, so two things, yeah, I'd say to that is that the thing about, there's a moment in, you know, the song about the internet in which he says, you know, do we think that taking our children's brains and is actually not a good thing to have done? Again, yeah, I think we're all kind of on the same page with that. I think that the internet and social media has created a generation who had to deal with things that the people that created that technology didn't think about. I'm not saying, you know, evil internet, because I don't believe that. But I do think that people who grew up, the first generations to grow up in the age of social media, were basically like kids being allowed to run across a 5-lane highway and see which ones of them got to the other side. And I think that's been brutal. And I think that it was, from a kind of social experiment point of view, I do think that a whole load of people suffered really badly because nobody had really thought it through. Or if they had thought it through, they would just, you know, let's wait and see. And I think that Bo Burnham actually brilliantly describes that in Eighth Grade, because I think that at the center of Eighth Grade is somebody who's wedded to the idea that they have to present an online version of themselves, when actually what they're dealing with is internal. I think that Eighth Grade is the most, it's lovely. I love that film.
Yeah,
it's heartbreaking,
incredible.
And it's precise, and also it's not preachy. And I think, you know, I read an interview with Bo Burnham in which he was talking about the way in which people have talked about Gen Z, you know, kids, in this kind of, you know, patronizing lost generation way. And he was saying, that's literally alien speak. That is not what's going on. You actually have to understand it from the inside. And I thought that one of the things about Eighth Grade was it was one of the very few films about that that didn't look to me like it was made by somebody like me. I mean, I would contrast it, for example, with Larry Clark's Kids, which I think is a massively stupid movie and is a perfect example of what I think it was the Village Voice critic described as a right-wing, rabble-rousing tell-me-off-a-thon. You know, an old man making a film about all the things that young kids are getting up to, which was kind of like, you know, some sort of public information film. Parents, be scared. Your children are out there taking drugs, yeah, having sex and giving each other AIDS. You know, that's what it felt like.
Whereas Eighth Grade feels like he's going, here's a reality where this just exists.
Yes, and also it actually looked like he understood what it... So again, I'm very cautious about saying that everything that I'm saying in the context of this, and this is why I'm trying to frame this. I mean, this is an interesting discussion about criticism, Jack. I'm trying to frame this within the context of, I think that your response is more valid than mine. I think that your response is actually more important to the piece than mine is. I think that part of my response is that I'm out of this loop somewhat.
Do you know what? I think it's because, I'll let you finish that thought, but I just want to say, I think it's because I grew up, and obviously I made YouTube stuff, but I grew up, literally, I watched it with my housemate when the second time I watched it, and he said that felt like a big YouTube project, and that's what I think it kind of is. So when I hear you be like, it feels like indulgent, I'm like, yeah, we all are a bit indulgent.
Yeah, and hey, you know, I'm the most indulgent person I know. I mean, you know, honestly, my prime subject of interest is me. I think anyone who's ever, you know,
I think everybody is the same though. I think that's on some level, but I think that's what's kind of amazing about this is that at the end of the show, he's saying like, you know, you say the oceans are rising, like I give a shit, like, and that song's called All Eyes on Me. Like, he's basically confessing almost to say, like, all I care about is myself. And yeah, I think this is kind of commendable to sort of like be that honest.
It's yes, but is it entertaining?
And hell yeah.
Okay, fine. And again, this is why I come back to it. I do think this is important. I think that to widen this out from the specifics of this particular special, which you've seen many times, I've seen once, you loved, didn't work for me, within the context
which I will say has disappointed me.
No, I'm sure. And I mean, you know, I will watch it again. But within the context of somebody who I actually think has done great work and may even have done great work that I just can't see right now, within the greater context of criticism, this raises an interesting point, which is, you know, all viewpoints are subjective. Any criticism is subjective. And if you are not willing to ask yourself whether your own particular response to something, I don't mean you, Jack, I'm doing the thing now, I'm talking to me.
One.
If one is not willing to ask oneself whether one's own response is actually appropriate to judge that piece of art, then you're not doing the job. And I have always tried with, you know, film criticism to at least attempt to understand whether or not the film is playing to it, is doing what it needs to do. I've always said that the rules of film criticism are, you know, describe the film accurately, put the film in context, ask whether the film succeeds on its own terms, whether, you know, no matter what it is, whether it achieves, and then beyond that, the sort of the greater question. But I think, oddly, the thing that I kind of became most vexed by watching Inside was the question of, well, this isn't working for me. And does that matter? And does it matter that I'm thinking, you know, you are falling in, not you, what Bo Burnham is doing, although the character of Bo Burnham is doing in that piece, mm-hmm, is falling into the thing that I regard as least valid, which is navel gazing, because my tolerance for navel gazing is fairly small. And I did start, and that's why, okay, so two things.
What do you mean navel gazing?
I mean, looking at your, you know, there's an old joke about, there's, you know, the guy sitting, gazing at his navel, and he thinks, you know, my head has all my thoughts, and my hands do all my actions, and my arms lift things up, and my legs move me around, and but my navel doesn't do anything. what is it there for? I mean, why is it there? And he gets more and more annoyed by it. And finally, he reaches this state of kind of zen. He just thinks, I'm not having that useless thing in my body. And he grabs a knife and he cuts his belly button out. And he thinks, oh, I feel better for that. And he stands up and his legs fall off. You know, it's like stupid joke about, but it's the kind of the essence of, you know, navel gazing is, you know, contemplating the existence of your navel, which is the most pointless thing in the world. So I have two questions I'm going to come back to. Firstly, do you think the crying is crying or acting? And tell me what you think and why you think it.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
My feeling on this is I don't care. To me, it doesn't matter if it's real or if it's not, because to me, the sentiment of it, whether it was prepared or not, the way that like any, because this is another thing I'll kind of link it to, the way that any film uses emotion. And I know that he's talking a lot in this about how people perform for you on camera.
Yeah.
And but you know, in life everybody's doing a performance all the time. And I don't think it is. I think there are a few moments.
What, you don't think it's real?
I don't think it is a real moment.
No.
I don't think it really is happening like that in that moment. Okay. I don't know.
Okay. Neither do I. So what's it doing there?
The same thing that any other film is doing, which is making its point. And I think that how he feels is true, but I think he's creating a moment that you will buy into the way that you're supposed to buy into any narrative in a film. Because as you mentioned, the character of Bo Burnham, which he sets up in the first moment of this film, where he is singing his opening song, where he says, "Sorry that I've been gone. Robert's been a little depressed. Wah. But I made you some content."
Yeah,
and
which is a joke about content, because the use of the word content is a joke. And then when he says content, he looks up and the light thing,
the glitter ball, spins lights around the room.
Actually, thinking back, that joke is funnier than I gave it credit for. Yeah,
it's so great, and he's wearing a little headpiece the entire, like a little torch on his head the entire time, and you don't know what it is for that first, you know, opening seconds of the film. But I think he's very specifically separating Robert from himself, because I've never heard him refer to himself as Robert. And if we take some of his previous work, when he's been the performer, he's done jokes and bits on stage where he's like knocked a water bottle over and been like, oh, sorry, that was a great way to start. Don't worry, we can edit that out. And then he plays a track that goes, he meant to knock the water over. Yeah, yeah, art is a lie. Nothing is real. And then he just carries on. And I think bringing that thought into this, I think it's the same idea, which is like, there are constant moments, like there's moments when he like pulls a wire to look at the monitor and pulls the camera with it.
Yes.
Now, to me, that feels like it absolutely could be a moment where he's setting something up and doing a test. And because I recognize that,
yeah,
like
I've done that before. We have all done that. Yes.
And when you're setting things up on your own, and you know, you have to go from being essentially grip technician, director of photography, and then switch into performer. oh, it's exhausting. So when you just can't get the shot the way you want it and you're just tugging just to see if something's right and then you bring the whole thing down, you know, that is, oh, just the moment of anxiety there was very real. But it might have been, he might have set that whole thing up because that shot that he's setting up never returns. We don't ever see that again. Yep. So that could have been a bit that was cut out that he was going to do, or it might have been set up for that exact moment.
Yeah.
But I don't think it matters because I think he's making a feature film about a character called Bo Burnham who is making a show for you, and at the same time he's showing you Robert, or at least how to honestly portray Robert. Because another thing is he's always aware when the camera's on. And so that relationship, the way you are on camera versus the way you are when a camera isn't on, changes. I don't know if you've ever seen the show Nathan For You.
No.
It's hilarious. And I think you should at least watch an episode. It is amazing. And the conceit of it is that Nathan Fielder goes around making a reality show where he acts really weird and normal. Not people wouldn't say it was normal, but he's acting like he's having a normal interaction. But everybody he's talking to knows that there's a camera.
Okay.
So they're performing for the camera and trying to act like they're doing a show. So, for example, there's a bachelorette type show that he goes on, and he purposefully acts really weird on the dates, but all the girls that he's dating know that they're on a reality show about dating, so they're trying to play the role and they're trying to like construct this reality that we all know is fake, and he's revealing that. And I think that's what Bo Burnham's doing as well.
Okay, well, that sounds fascinating. Okay, so again, so my two sort of slightly snippy things would be
go on.
Firstly, you know, Brechtian alienation, you know, we're doing this, but we're telling you we're doing this. I mean, my argument about that in theatre was always, you know, that they break the fourth wall and they go, yeah, it's not real, it's a show. And I go, I know it's a show. I paid 15 quid and my ass hurts. You know, that's...
Right, so you're not interested in Brechtian sort of stuff?
No, I'm not interested in it. I mean, it's just that I'm 60, Jack, you know, I'd like...
That explains your relationship with Charlie Kaufman.
No, it doesn't explain my relationship with Charlie Kaufman. that's a whole other kettle of fish. It's just a bit like, oh, it's not real. I go, yeah, I know. The second...
But he's making you question it, though. Like, you're going, is that crying real? And you've decided it isn't, but there's still a moment of doubt of whether or not it is.
Okay, but the thing is, so I'll bring it to my second point, which is that my good friend Tim Polecat, who was the lead singer of the Polecats, once said something which I consider to be probably the most profound thing anyone has ever said about filmmaking. I don't think I've ever told you this story. I don't think I've ever told anyone this story before, but it's...
Kermit, sorry, I'll retake that. A Kermode on Film exclusive.
Yeah, you meant to say Kermody, you meant to knock the bottle over. so now they'll have to leave it in, otherwise that won't make sense. Okay. So,
oh, no.
So Tim said this thing to me once. This was back in the 80s, right? It was in the early days of video cameras. And Tim had a very fine way with words. And he was also somebody who, you know, he was somebody who believed that avant-garde was French for bullshit. And Tim said, brilliant. You know, the truth is, if you stick anyone alone in a room with a video camera, give them enough time, they will film their own asshole. And I actually think that that is a very good rule of filmmaking, that if you put anyone alone in a room with a camera for long enough, they will end up filming their own asshole. And I think that applies... It's to do with solipsism and...
It's got layers.
It's got layers. And the more I think about it, the more I think that's... You know, people talk about all you need for a movie is a gun, and they go, forget all that nonsense. I think Tim was right. It is to do with you crawl... You know, you just crawl up your own backside.
Bo Burnham literally does expose himself...
Yes.
Almost full frontal.
I know. And that's the other thing. It's the kind of, you know, here he is in his pants and here he is in his. There are other filmmakers who do a similar thing, you know, during the kind of the self-revelation thing. I mean, there's a moment when he, you know, he imagines himself crucified, which is kind of the point at which he's going, I know what I'm doing. I'm doing the thing which he's doing it all the way through. But there is also the, you know, you've left somebody alone for long enough on their own with a camera and they're pretty much fulfilling the Tim Polecat rule of cinema. To move on from that to the question about stage fright, the reason I do find this fascinating is because, and again, I don't know whether I've told you.
To be honest, I don't know. I don't know if what Bo Burnham was having would be considered stage fright.
Okay, a panic attack on stage. Okay, which is a kind of, you know, it's part. The reason I say this is this: many years ago, I had a panic attack on air, live on air, and I fainted.
Wow.
Okay, it was on Radio 1. I was doing a show with Mark Radcliffe and I think Mark Lamont. It was up in Manchester. A whole bunch of things were going on, like too many things were going on. I was traveling backwards and forwards between Liverpool, Manchester, London, blah, blah, blah. I was on air, and the only best way of describing this is if you're riding a bike and you don't think about it, it's fine. But the minute somebody says to you, how are you doing that? You fall off, okay? Something happened, and I was in the middle of talking. I was literally talking about something, and I stopped breathing, and I couldn't breathe. My throat, I could not breathe, and I fell off the chair, and they went to a record. And Mark Riley rushed in, and they assumed, as you would do, that I was having an asthma attack. I don't have asthma, but he gave me an inhaler, and I did that, and I, you know, inhaled with it, and I convinced myself that what it was an asthma attack, despite the fact that I don't have asthma.
So I suppose we're also going back a few years when mental health wasn't as much of a topic.
Yeah, but also, you know, sometime later I kind of fessed up, and I wrote about this in a book, and sometime later I fessed up to the fact that what happened was I just suddenly had some kind of completely, and it really disorientated me. Firstly, because I was a broadcaster, and this is a long time ago. You know, how am I going to function if I can't do this? You know, how am I going to earn a living if I can't do this? And so there was a kind of long process, but I got through it, and I came out the other end of it, and it was all fine. And, you know, now one of the things that's great about it now is people always say, well, what's the worst thing that can happen? Well, when the worst thing that can happen happens, and you go, oh yeah, it was that, then it's fine. It doesn't scare you anymore. So it's interesting. Sometimes the worst thing that can happen happening is good. But mm-hmm. sometime later, Mark Lawson talked to me about it, and he said he wanted to write a book about stage fright, the phenomenon of panic attacks in performance mode. Mm-hmm. And he said, would you talk to me? I said, yeah, because I'm not, you know, I'm quite open about it. I said, I've written about it anyway. And but he never got the book written. And the reason he didn't was that nobody would talk to him about it. Because if you are a performer, talking about stage fright is an absolute no-no, because it basically means you're unreliable. Even if you've overcome it, you know, it's some of these weird, really weird things. So
that's an interesting interpretation of that. I wouldn't assume that, and I don't know if everybody would assume that now.
No, I think the things have changed very much. I mean, this was this was back then. But he said he wanted to write this book and he couldn't, because people would tell him stories of, you know, that they do, and then he'd say, "Can I write?" They said, "No, you can't use my name." And it was just a peculiar thing. And actually, I thought that the most interesting thing for me, because in the end, as the thing, it's all about me, is the thing. I did find that. Like, okay, there's a door in there that I can... But for a lot of the rest of it, I found myself more disconnected. So look, to attempt to bring this to some kind of close, I do think that there's a lot of stuff going on in that special, and I think it might be that it is as brilliant as you think it is. I'm troubled that I didn't get that out of it. And so I want you to finish by telling me what I'm getting wrong and how I could get into it.
I genuinely don't know if I can, because like you said, everything is subjective. But the only thing I can tell you is that the first time I watched it, I also came away being like, yeah, good, definitely want to watch it again, but good. And also because it's relatively longer than a lot of specials are.
Yeah.
An hour and a half. So when you get to the ending and the tone has changed so drastically, I think you kind of forget where you've started. But I think try and maybe watch it more like you're watching a film. Like, he knows he's making a narrative piece. And for me, the whole thing, to respond to that story about stage fright, it feels to me like an intentional reverse of that. Like, he feels like he's exposing himself so much in the way that YouTube people did to begin with, which is how I got influenced to start making things, was, oh, people like me can just make stuff. Like, the reason why I was inspired to be a filmmaker, of course, was my love of cinema, but also it was because I saw a good friend of mine now called Dominic Ferrer, who's an American friend of mine who is the same age, making movies just with his friends on the internet. And I saw him doing that and thought, I can do that. And the reason why I started editing and got an idea is because I saw someone doing fan trailers and I thought, I could do that. And that's what I think Bo Burnham is doing now, is if you struggle with this stuff, it doesn't mean you can't create this stuff. And my interpretation of the ending as well, you know, how I've talked about, I think that room is real for Bo Burnham every single time he wants to make something. At the end of it, obviously, there's a we're going to have to leave all the mistakes in you on are. This now. Otherwise,
this is a sort of trick.
he does like a trick where he goes out, and it really, you know, we reveal that he's been on stage the entire time. That spotlight is still haunting him, and then it cuts back again to him watching himself, and it feels like when he smiles, it's that to me feels like him going, "That was all worth it," because it made me feel that at the end, like I got a smile out of it, and I'm proud of it, and I will do that again. I will go back into that room and make something again, even though you can see how much it takes from me and the panic it induces in me and all the different emotions it sort of conjures up. But I will do it again because I'm addicted. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but I think I think he's just saying, this is who I am and this is what I'm like.
Okay. That hasn't quite done the trick, but it was a very good run at it.
Will you watch it again? Yeah, I will. And if you feel differently, we'll talk about it.
I will, and not least because, you know, I respect your opinion on it, and because there's a big part of me thinks that I'm just, you know, I'm missing something, which is
maybe you watched it when you were in the wrong mood or something.
Yeah, again, like, that is something which is always possible, because as we know, the mood and the place and the room that you are in or whatever can affect it. So I will watch it again. It's been interesting.
Have you spoken to Gabriel about it? Have you spoken to
him? He hasn't seen it yet. So in fact, funnily enough, I did send him a message saying, have you seen it? He said, no, I'm saving it to watch it in the right circumstance.
Yeah, a lot of my friends have done the exact same thing.
Yeah, and I kind of, you know, I respect that because that's the way to do it. It's like, you know, I've got a new album by somebody, I'm not going to listen to it until I can, you know, until I'm absolutely in the right place to do it. However, I also think it's been a more interesting discussion as a result of this, other than the two of us going, yeah, it was great, and I loved that bit, and I loved that bit.
I agree, yeah. I didn't know how you'd respond to it. But yeah, I think that as well, like I'm like so familiar with the songs now as well. Like he released the album, or the songs as he's calling it, which I think is another evidence to me that he's made a film, because he's not said here's the album version, he said here's the songs from
Jack, a pleasure as always. Lockdown is I suppose coming to an end at some point in the next few months. I mean, obviously we have the,
as we mentioned, you're double vaxxed.
I am double vaxxed, yeah, I know. I've got, it's like superpower, it's a thing, although it's, you know, obviously I would say this to everybody, you know, listening, wearing masks is still important, social distancing is still important. Somebody sent me a message,
how's the Microsoft effects?
Oh, it's great. I get Wi-Fi wherever I go now. It's absolutely brilliant. I'm constant GPS what's his name, who's the person who's controlling me? Who is it?
Bill Gates.
Yeah, Bill
Gates. Stop pretending that you've forgotten. It's like a really bad giveaway that you know exactly who you're talking about because you've been injected with his little chip or serum or whatever he's putting in.
That's right, yeah. But it's, you know, that's really what...
Is that what it's done? It's made you forget Bill Gates' name, but he's controlling everything you've ever done.
That's right, yeah. He's controlling all my thoughts, but I can't remember him. But I would say somebody sent me... I put a picture up on Twitter of me and Linda after we'd had our, you know, second vaccination. And we were wearing masks because we'd gone to the vaccine to have it done. And I said, you know, love is getting your second vaccination together. And somebody responded, said, yeah, but you're still wearing masks, aren't you, sheep? To which my answer would be, go fuck yourself, dickface. So anyway.
It's not a mask, it's a muzzle.
Yeah, it's a muzzle, you sheep. I'm not going to have mine done because I want the right to get... Yeah, so I just...
Why do you think you're smarter than smarter people than you? Because, I don't understand.
Because some people are assholes.
Yeah, there we go.
And there we go. And on that bombshell, thanks, Jack. if you are an anti-vaxxer or an anti-masker, please stop subscribing. There are many other QAnon podcasts out there that you'd enjoy a lot more. And frankly, we don't want you. For the rest of you, stay safe, stay well. Thanks for listening. See you all soon. Keep watching the skies.
I wanted to do it at the same time, and we did, because this was all rehearsed. Art is a lie. Nothing is real.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.